With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Omira and Borgeson on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to the Omira and Borgeson Show. I'm Christina Borgeson.
And I'm Kelly O'Mara. The first half of this hour, we're going to focus on why our veterans are killing themselves in record numbers. A recent report by America's Warrior Partnership found that the actual suicide rate of veterans is much higher than is reported by the Department of Veterans Affairs. The VA says, however, that veterans age 18 to 64 die each day by suicide, but AWP says the reality is that the number is 24 a day, or 1.4 times the official rate. According to the VA, in 2020, the rate of veteran suicides was 57.3% higher than non-veterans. So what's going on with our military personnel? Given that DOD gets more money than God, including $21 trillion it can't account for, you'd think that they could find some taxpayer money and throw it toward getting to the bottom of why our military personnel are killing themselves at such high rates. Dr. Graham of the Veterans Administration had this to say about how the psychiatric treatments work for PTSD.
The way the medicines work are not to create new chemicals. What they do is just help normalize the balance of chemicals that are usually off inside your brain already. If you have too much serotonin or too much norepinephrine or too little of this or too little of that, that's when things get kind of out of whack and you have problems. So what the medicines are doing is trying to help put all these chemicals back in the normal, regular proportions.
The old chemical imbalance theory. So given that suicides are higher than ever, is it really an effective way to treat our veterans? Our guest today is Dr. Bart Billings, a retired Army colonel, PhD, who's been working in the mental health field for 50 years. He founded the International Military and Civilian Combat Stress Conference and is the author of the extremely important book, Invisible Scars: How to Treat Combat Stress and PTSD Without Medication. Thank you, Colonel Billings, for coming on the show and talking with us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We just heard from Dr. Graham of the VA explaining how the psychiatric drug treatments work on PTSD. After hearing that, Colonel Billings, why do you think the VA is still using the completely debunked chemical imbalance theory to support its psychiatric drugging treatments?
Well, it's all about money. Psychiatry and the pharmaceutical industry generates $1/3 trillion each year peddling brain-altering black box warning psychiatric meds. One of the things that happened just yesterday, it's coincidental to our conversation now, is I was invited by the San Diego Padres to join them in the owner's box when they celebrate POWs. And there were a number of POWs in the owner's box from all wars. It made me think. And a lot of people don't know this. When I was writing the book, Invisible Scars, I did a lot of research to find out about suicides in the military. And one of the things I found out is that no prisoner of war in Vietnam, and there were hundreds, ever committed suicide in captivity. Isn't that interesting? One of the reasons I feel they never committed suicide is they weren't being given psychiatric brain-altering medications. They were given lousy food. They were tortured, but they weren't given brain-altering psychiatric meds. When they came back after the war, they started medicating them, and then you saw suicides. Now, isn't it interesting? Not one suicide of a POW in captivity, being tortured, brutalized, starved, committed suicide. What does that tell you?
Wow. Wow, that's very interesting piece of data. it tells me that, you know, you and I have worked on this for a long time. I mean, I've been writing about, you know, military suicides, as have you. And the thing that I don't understand is that the VA has clearly, they understand that the chemical imbalance theory has been thoroughly, completely debunked. Yet on their website, veterans who go to that website are going to listen to Dr. Graham and, you know, they're going to think, oh, it's because I have, you know, the chemicals in my brain, you know, are out of whack. This is very unfair. It is very unfair to them to pass off information like that when they know it's wrong.
You know, I just want to weigh in here. I think there's that old adage, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting the same result. So if they have a situation where these suicides have been escalating now for years, and they've been giving these kids the drugs for years.
Well, over 20.
Why do they keep expecting the same results? Or do they care? I mean, you mentioned the profit motive, but that seems so terribly cynical when you're talking about people who actually put their lives on the line for their country, and they come back and they're treated like profit centers.
Well, I was giving a lecture, and one of the people in the audience asked the same question. How can the government allow this to happen for well over 20 years? 22 suicides a day. And even several years ago, they were saying it was really more because a lot don't get reported. How come that's happening? Well, you know, I have a friend who was a POW for 7.5 years. And I asked him one day, I said, you're getting disability, Social Security, you're getting all kind of benefits from your disability of being a POW, being in the military. And I said, what would happen to all of those benefits? He was getting somewhere around $6,000-$7,000 a month. And I said, what would happen to those benefits if tomorrow you committed suicide? Would your wife get them? And he said, no, all that money would go back to the government. That got me thinking. Each person who commits suicide, the government is making money. If this was a war and we were losing 22 people a day, 24 people a day, they'd be marching in the streets. Mm-hmm. How come we're losing 22, 24, 26 veterans a day to suicide and they're not marching in the streets? Well, right. When you stop and think about it, and this is real, I'm not making this up. Every suicide, whatever benefits they get, basically most of them go back to the government. To me, that's an answer. It's like, it's profitable. The government really doesn't care because they're making money for every veteran that commits suicide. Now, that's terrible.
Well, it seems to me that their deception knows no bounds. I was actually looking at the Department of Veterans Affairs, their website, and it says the four most prescribed drugs for veterans to treat PTSD is Zoloft, Paxil, Prozac, and Effexor. All of these carry the black box warning for suicidality. Yet, the only side effects mentioned on the VA website, and I mean, I'm going to quote it, mild to moderate side effects such as upset stomach, sweating, headache, and dizziness. Some people have sexual side effects. I'm like, look, given the fact that you're giving these people black box warning drugs, in other words, the black box warning is for suicidality. These drugs may cause you to commit suicide.
And homicidality too, right?
Not like, on all of them.
Yes, homicide as well.
On all, you know, of those?
Yeah, in my book, I listed the mass shooters, and over 90% of the mass shooters, school shooters, et cetera, were on some form at the time of or previous to psychiatric medications. The side effect, the first side effect to black box warning psychiatric medications is suicide, right. Depression, homicide is there. So when you see a shooter kill a whole bunch of people and he kills himself, that's consistent with the side effects. I was giving a lecture and I had a physician in the audience and I deferred to him. I said, could you tell the rest of the audience, you're a medical doctor, you've been in practice a long time, what does black box warning mean? And he just stood up, he turned around to the audience and said, it could kill you.
Of course. But again, they're withholding information that our veterans and our military personnel need to know. Okay. Yeah. They need to know that this is a serious, serious drug with serious side effects. And they're not even putting that on their website.
No. In my book, Invisible Scars, which came out a few years back. And if any listeners want to look at the book website, it's just BartPBillings.com. In the book, I explained exactly post-traumatic stress. I don't call it a disorder. I call it a normal reaction to being in an abnormal environment. Don't let anybody tell you it's a disorder. If I see PTSD on any paperwork from a veteran, I don't see that D as disorder. I see it that somebody has got the permission to drug them. PTS drugged. That's if they put that down, I see the D as drugged. And of course, the side effects are disastrous. And, you know, you go back to what I said before, I never thought about it until I talked to my friend, how much money the government would get back if he committed suicide the next day. It's a terrible thought, but it's factual.
Let me ask you, I actually have two questions. One is, are some of these veterans waking up to this and filing lawsuits against the government for this drugging treatment? And the second thing is, what are the alternative treatments that are much better for treating?
Easy questions to answer. Yes, they are. A veteran in Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, was drugged to the max. He was a Marine, and he filed suit against the government. And I have a description of that in the book and some of the quotes from what happened in court. He won because of standard of care was violated. They just drugged him. They did no treatment. $7 million. And whoa. The government appealed it, and the appeal wound up, he still got, I think, $4 million. I tell people in the book, if you're a veteran and this has happened to you, find a lawyer. Go after them. That's the only thing they understand is money. Now, why? What alternative treatment? Integrative treatment. Integrative treatment, there's many of them. There's biofeedback. There's guided imagery. There's yoga. I mean, there's 35 of them. There's nutrition. The integrative treatment works. Well, how come they're not getting integrative treatment? Well, most of the physicians who work with veterans, thousands of staff at the VA are psychiatrists who make money prescribing medications. They should be physiatrists. A physiatrist is a physical medicine and rehabilitation physician. The AMA sanctioned that profession in 1937. Yet I give lectures with medical people in the audience and I mention physiatrist, they don't even know what a physiatrist is. It should be the opposite. 70% of the physicians working with veterans and the VA should be physiatrists. There's only 400 nationally. There's thousands of psychiatrists. There's your answer. That's the reason they're not getting the integrative treatment that would help them understand, you know, their traumatic brain injuries, that post-traumatic stress is a normal reaction. I have that in the first chapter of the book. I gave a lecture, a book signing and a lecture. And after, a gentleman came up to me and he said, boy, it sounded like you were talking to me. And I said, well, I'm happy to hear that. And he said, I want a book. So I signed a book. I gave it to him. And about 2 weeks later, he called me up because I put my car in the book. And he said, I went to your lecture on Saturday. I had it all figured out on Monday how I was going to commit suicide. I read the book and realized, wow, this is really what's happening? All these meds? That's the reason I can't see straight? And that's the reason I was going to commit suicide. He said, the book saved my life. Thanks. And I've received dozens of emails and calls telling me the same thing. I was going to commit suicide. I read the book. And when they read the book, the first chapter explains about these medications and what they could do. And post-traumatic stress is a normal reaction to being in an abnormal environment, not only for vets, but for everybody. And it saved lives when they understand how destructive and the reason they're feeling the way they are.
Let me ask you something. Oh, go ahead, Kelly.
Yeah, I just said, I want to make the point. And I think, you know, what we should also do is kind of, we have the opportunity, let's kind of educate any veterans out there who are listening. You know, when the VA says that we're giving you these drugs because, you know, they're going to balance your, you know, chemicals in your brain, you know, the first thing you have to kind of say to that doctor, if that's what they're telling you, is really, what test did you do to measure my brain chemicals so that you can tell me not only what drug you're going to give me, for how long you're going to give it to me, and when are we going to test my chemicals again to see if they're now, you know, at normal levels? Because the fact is they can't. So spewing this nonsense, okay, by the VA, this is insulting to me, and it should be insulting to any veteran. Would you agree with me?
I totally agree.
We have to take a break right now.
What I would say is, there's not one lab test, urine analysis, scan that would substantiate any diagnosis in psychiatry's DSM, their diagnostic manual, that would be different than anybody who's totally normal. So it would not be unusual for a person to see four psychiatrists and get four different labels so they can medicate them. And every time they review that DSM to add more labels so they can give more drugs, it's basically senseless. These diagnoses are senseless. There's no science to them.
We have to take a break right now. This is Omira and Borgeson. We'll be right back after these messages.
Patrick Henningsen on TNT Radio.
It's going to be a lot of pressure on Washington, on the White House Democratic Party, to chart some kind of roadmap with this, not this open-ended thing. Biden did this interview with 60 Minutes and just left it open-ended. So we're gonna back the Ukrainians as long as it takes, as long as it takes. He's whispering to the guy in 60 Minutes with a kind of creepy Biden whisper. As long as it takes, as long as it takes. We're going to give them more weapons, lots of weapons. Anyway, this week's a game changer. There's no doubt about that. There's no doubt about that. With the referendums in the Donbass regions and also in Kherson South and in Zaporizhia, which is sort of south central, the referendums are a game changer. And I think that you're seeing the panic because, you know, Western countries that fancy themselves as nation builders, Iraq, look at Iraq, they're running into this sort of double standard of hypocrisy, and they're really hitting a wall with this. They don't know how to respond to Russia. Russia's giving a master class in nation building.
Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
What? Are you kidding me?
If you can't believe what you're hearing, then get the straight talk from us. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. You're with the O'Meara and Borgeson Show. We are talking with Colonel Bart Billings today regarding the enormous increase in veteran suicides. You know, Colonel Billings, one of the questions I have, and I'd like you to kind of get into a little bit of detail. You hold your stress conference every year. I'm assuming you're still doing that. Is that right? Or
yeah, I do actually.
Okay, so can you tell us a little bit about what you get back? Tell us what the conference is, and then what it is you're getting back from, you know, the veterans and soldiers that you're working with.
Yeah, the International Combat Stress Conference originated back in the early 90s. I was a hospital commander. My whole hospital got deployed during the Persian Gulf. And a lot of it came back with problems. So we started the conference, and I haven't done it for a few years, but it lasted for 24 years. It was the longest running conference on combat stress in the world. People came from all over the world to attend that conference, families, soldiers, scientists, et cetera. One of the things that we found out from the conference, and that's what led to the book Invisible Scars, all these years of hearing people say in the audience, yeah, they put me on those psychiatric meds and I felt like a zombie. I couldn't function. My friend was on them. He couldn't stand it. He committed suicide. It was obvious with direct feedback. And psychiatry, after the 15th year, 16th year, we exposed this at one of the conferences. Military psychiatry refused to attend the conference if we didn't change our opinions.
And wow.
They refused. They blackballed it. It still went on. We had lots of people come, but they said, we won't come unless you invite people who would substantiate what we are doing, to substantiate the drugging. And I says, I can't do that. I'm inviting people who can best help the people attending the conference understand what's going on. Psychiatry, we had a few who were opposed to the standard, practice of psychiatry. But yeah, that's what happened. But that's what we
discovered. Let me ask you something. You mentioned earlier that the psychiatrists actually make money prescribing these drugs.
They charge. They charge for the visit. Psychiatry.
Oh, they charge for the visit, but they don't get a kickback for using certain.
There's medical schools. Yeah, there's kickback from the drug companies. There definitely is. Wow. They pay for people to come out, that visit, the psychiatrists, to lecture, to go on trips, conferences. Medical schools or psychiatry department actually gets funding. I mean, the FDA gets funded by the pharmaceutical companies, millions every year push through certain drugs. You know what scares me more than anything right now? With the vaccines. In California, a bill, I don't know if the governor signed it, was put on his desk stating that anyone who disagrees with giving people the vaccine, anyone who has any different opinions than, quote, the science of giving these vaccines, we don't want to hear doctors say that there's early treatment that's effective. No, they don't want to hear any of that. And if that gets signed, any physician who works with a patient who goes against what the government says is official could lose their license. The next step is this that scares me. The next step is psychiatry can propose the science of working with post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury. The science is psychiatric medications. Anybody who does anything other than this will lose their license. That's pretty darn scary.
You know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking there's some major class action lawsuits here that could be made. A, for the malpractice of throwing all these antipsychotic drugs, these SSRIs, as the formal treatment for PTSD, because the record of suicides shows that this is malpractice. And same thing for the vaccines. You know, if you're saying the science says these things are safe and effective, bring your science. The other side can bring its science to show, you know, the record of how dangerous these vaccines are and fight it out in court. But I think this is what's going to have to happen, because they can't just stand up and say, oh, yes, this is the standard of care and it works, because the dead bodies have been piling up now for a couple of decades.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you try to find out what type of drugs a soldier or anybody was on prior to their suicide. You can't get that information. That's really hard to find. I had a Marine here. It wasn't my patient or anything, but I got a call from his attorney. He committed suicide. They sent me his medical record. He was on 4, 5, or 6 different psychiatric medications.
Cocktails. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He took a gun. He went to a gun range and he shot himself in the head.
Yeah. It's very typical. And the thing
is, it's hard to find that. The drug companies keep that a secret.
Yeah. But their families have their families know their medical records. They have the bottles at home. So, you know, you can get around that. But the thing is that, you know, this has got to be addressed, and it's got to be addressed in the courts and brought to an end. Listen, we want to thank you so much for coming on. I mean,
yes, Colonel. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you so much for your work. And we just want to plug your book one more time. Your book is called Invisible Scars: How to Treat Combat Stress and PTSD Without Medication. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So our next guest, he's quite the fighter, talking about fighting the government. On some legal cases, breakthroughs are simply miracles, like in the case we're going to talk about now. After 5 hard years, ex-Justice Department lawyer Ty Clevenger just won a stunning decision in his fight with the FBI to get to the bottom of what happened to murdered DNC staffer Seth Rich. On September 29, 2022, federal judge Amos Mazant court ordered the government to give Clevenger access to, are you listening, information on Seth Rich's laptop within 2 weeks. A decision, by the way, made on the heels of a recently published book by ProPublica investigative reporter Andy Kroll, explaining how in the, quote, age of conspiracy, people are refusing to accept that Rich was simply murdered during a botched robbery, even though no robber or anyone else has ever been arrested in the case. Kroll takes his swipes at Clevenger in the book, but Clevenger, in massive, artfully fought battles against government FOIA offices, has not only won big this time, but in the course of his journey, documented deep corruption and deception on the part of his adversaries. He's here to talk about all that today. Welcome, Ty.
Thank you, Christina. Thank you for having me.
So I guess the first thing I'm going to ask you is, what arguments from the FBI side did you have to overcome to win this decision?
Oh, wow. Of course, with the laptop, the government had a pretty weak argument. They just said it was, they said it was privacy. And under the law, the privacy of a deceased person is greatly diminished. So they did not have, that was their weakest spot. They argued more forcefully, or at least had better arguments on some of the other issues, like emails from the FBI. But hey, I mean, it's a big win for us. We're glad to have it. A lot of people have been speculating, oh, well, the laptop's been scrubbed and files have been deleted. I am operating under the assumption that they have. This is not so much about getting files from the laptop as getting the metadata from the laptop to see if any files were deleted, when were they deleted, and perhaps by whom were they deleted.
You know, I just have a quick question here. So I read part of this story this morning, and it shocked me that the FBI has been lying about just even having, you know, the data, the laptop, for so long. I mean, like 3.5 years they lied, right?
Oh, yes. I wish I could say I was still shocked by that kind of stuff. I mean, I assume, seriously, and this is not just from FOIA stuff, it's from representing other clients. I assume the FBI is lying to me until they prove otherwise.
Well, yeah. So they've been lying for 3.5 years. Now a judge is going to, you know, has said, hey, you know, cough it up. We know you have it. I mean, how can anybody really have any faith that it hasn't been manipulated? I mean, again, I'm just throwing it out there. They've had plenty of time to do that.
Well, we know, for example, that shortly after the murder, the family, somebody in the family took custody of this laptop. So ask yourself this question: your son, brother, sister, whomever has just been murdered, and you go grab an electronic device and take it away instead of giving it to the police. I mean, why do you do that? There's just so much about this case that does not make sense. And going back to the metadata, you know, we would like to know, were files deleted while the family had the laptop? And part of the reason that's relevant is because Aaron Rich, who was the brother of Seth, sued multiple people, including one of my clients, because they said he had a role in assisting Seth in transferring emails to WikiLeaks. So if he's filing lawsuits and claiming he didn't do it, why does the family take the laptop like that? And so those are the kind of questions we want to try to answer.
Did the family turn the laptop over to the FBI?
Eventually they did. And interestingly, in one of its responses, the FBI says, well, we didn't look at this thing because we could not vouch for the contents. Basically a chain of custody issue. Still, you would look at it. I mean,
still going to be an issue for you if you in any cases that you want to bring forward?
Not really. If we can prove that files were deleted within the relevant time period, that's enough of a smoking gun that it will allow us to perhaps file other civil cases. And the advantage of doing that, it would be much faster than a FOIA case to just be able to issue a subpoena and force someone to turn something over. So that hopefully is where this is headed.
Now, one way that they tried to keep you from getting the contents of the laptop was to say that there were privacy issues connected to members of his family. But the judge didn't buy that.
He didn't. And just as a purely practical matter or moral matter, we're not looking to publish, you know, personal photos of him with his girlfriend or on the beach or whatever. I mean, if we make anything public, it's strictly going to be relevant to the question of whether he played any role in leaking these emails. So, you know, we don't want to embarrass anybody. But nonetheless, I mean, it's pretty clear under the law that once a person passes away, there's much less of a privacy interest to consider. The bigger issue. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just curious. So, when you get a hold of this, I guess you'll turn it over to data experts to go through it, look for the metadata, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Is there a fingerprint? Let's call it a fingerprint. After his death, his brother Aaron had it. The family had it, right?
Right. Somebody must be lying.
So there'll be a fingerprint if anything was deleted at that time. Is that correct?
There should be. Yes, there should be.
Okay, interesting. So you'll be able to identify that.
So that's why we got the expert. What were you going to say? The bigger issue?
Oh, yeah. My bigger concern is there was a lot of information that we did not get. So there's almost undoubtedly going to be an appeal. And it shows a bigger problem with the FBI. So, for example, if I sue a company on behalf of a client and I ask for emails about either one of you, they're going to have to search their entire email system or whoever I'm asking for. The FBI has this very, very strange setup where they absolutely refuse to search their email systems. And what they say is, in this case, they said that any emails of, quote, investigative significance, close quote, would have been put into their indexing system. So I was racking my brain over the weekend. I think it's been over 20 years since I put an email into a folder. So how many people actually take the time to pull an email out and put it into this special folder or flag it? I think the answer is almost never. But even the court acknowledged that it is completely subjective for an agent to decide whether something is quote unquote of significance. I mean, it's a completely undefined term. So if they want to hide something, guess what they do? They just don't put it into the index system. So anytime even if you specifically request emails, which I did, they still come back and say, well, if it was important, it would have been in our indexing system. So I'm going to ask the Court of Appeals once and for all to say that's absolutely not acceptable and you can't do business that way.
What is it that the judge did deny you?
He denied the email search that we had requested. They also they started off with 20,000 pages. They claimed that ultimately only about 1,500 of those were relevant. And then of those, they produced less than 200. And of the ones they did produce, a lot of them were heavily redacted. And so I asked the judge to just go through these and see if these redactions were proper, because you can only redact things based on certain statutory exemptions. And thus far, he has said, no, he's not going to do that. There's another set of records that we got late, which is insightful in and of itself. In the same FOIA request, I asked for all records from CrowdStrike, which is the private company that the DNC hired to investigate and determine who hacked or leaked their emails. Now, in the history of the FBI, I'm not aware of a single case where the FBI stood back and said, okay, private company, you can do the investigation and we'll just accept the results. But anyway, that's what the FBI did. They've got those records. So I asked for those CrowdStrike reports. They ignored me, just completely ignored the request, apparently hoping that I would forget or overlook that. And I didn't, and I pushed back. And they came back with 4 reports, and they redacted literally everything except the cover page, not one single word. So I'm asking the judge, I'll ask the judge again, yeah, to go through. I mean, you can't tell me there's not a sentence in those reports that can be disclosed, but clearly they're trying to hide something. So this is just normal FBI.
Unbelievable.
You know, it's interesting you bring up CrowdStrike. I remember when that came out, 4 or 5 years ago? And I pulled up the report. It was like 12 pages, what I got off of Google. And it said their conclusion was that they were only, and I'm quoting this, minimally certain that the DNC computers have been hacked. Minimally.
Yes, exactly. Well, and then you've got a report from Bill Binney, the former technical director of the National Security Agency, who said it was technologically and physically impossible to hack the DNC servers remotely and transfer the amount of data within the limited period of time. It could not be done with that big of a data set. And then there were other tags in the data that made it clear that the data was downloaded on something akin to a USB thumb drive. So we've got all that technical evidence And yet people like, what's his face, Andy Kroll, you know, formerly at Rolling Stone, oh, it's all a conspiracy theory. We're just supposed to swallow the government / DNC narrative and not ask any questions.
Oh, well, I mean, I sent you the pages in his book where he talked about you. Talk about that.
You know, I mean, he actually, okay, now I've got to be honest. I have not. I've not bribed myself to do it. And I'll tell you what, I've reached a point where I decided to shut out the naysayers. Eventually I will read it for your sake because you sent it to me. I don't want it getting inside of my head. I don't want it slowing me down. So I just don't pay attention.
Actually, what's interesting about it is, first of all, he stretches the truth quite a bit.
He usually does.
You and your back. And it's just, to me, this is a refreshment of the cover of this book. I'm not even going to mention the title.
Right.
People can look it up if they want. But listen, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. This is O'Meara and Borgeson. We'll be right back after these messages.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
So it turns out that if you're a stressed out coffee drinker, you're in luck. You might be helping yourself stay healthy and maybe even helping yourself live longer. I kid you not. There are two separate studies. StudyFinds.org says researchers from the Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine say the immune system can actually benefit from a little stress. Although stress plays a role in a number of health issues, the study finds it may also protect the body in certain circumstances. Experiments were conducted on mice. The message is that a little bit of stress is good in your life, but you want to be stressed in the right way. I don't know what that means. The other study says drink 2 to 3 cups of coffee a day for longer life and better heart health. It was authored by the head of clinical electrophysiology research at the Baker Heart and Diabetes Research Institute in Melbourne, Australia. The results suggest that mild to moderate intake of ground, instant, and decaffeinated coffee should be considered part of a healthy lifestyle. Coffee and stress. Who knew? Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
I'm Ben Affleck, and I want to thank you for joining me and supporting Paralyzed Veterans of America.
I'm a quadriplegic. I'm definitely at risk.
I'm very concerned about, would there be a bed for me? Would there be a ventilator for me?
Join me and help fight for them by supporting Paralyzed Veterans of America.
They're making sure that we have all of the food and supplies that we need right now.
To find out how you can help, please go to helppva.org. That's helppva.org.
The FISA warrants, misleading Congress, misleading the DOJ, misleading Donald Trump, the attack on Michael Flynn, Andrew McCabe fired, the Clinton emails, the Wiener laptop, Roger Stone, the January 6th Capitol riot, Hunter Biden protection, the Gretchen Whitmer plot, Kyle Rittenhouse, the Mar-a-Lago raid, years of irredeemable corruption by the FBI, lighting the fuse for freedom, TNT Radio.
Welcome back. This is the O'Meara and Borgeson Show. We've been talking with Ty Clevenger about his recent win in a judicious sense to get some more information about a laptop of Seth Rich. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So, Ty, you got info. You also asked for information on some other people. Cy Hirsch, FBI's Deborah Sines, FBI Director Andrew McCabe, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, and DNC Interim Chairwoman Donna Brazile. What'd you get on them?
I got nothing on them, but there's an interesting caveat to that. I had asked if any of those people had gone to meet with Andrew McCabe, and the FBI came back and said, we searched Andrew McCabe's email. We found no indication that they did. And so, okay, well, first of all, you've now made it clear that you are indeed capable of searching emails. And going back to the email issue, I'd said to the FBI, okay, if you're not going to search your whole system, then at least search the names of these agents who are already in the one string of emails that we know of. They refused. I said, search the emails of the agents who took the 302 interviews of witnesses. They refused. So it could be done, and they're just flatly refusing. But going back to Andrew McCabe, they didn't search his calendar. I mean, there are a lot of basic things they did not do to find out who he met with. And again, this is standard FBI, hide the ball.
So, I mean, Okay. I remember that I had written a list of all the stuff that adds up to this Seth Rich thing stinks. Okay. So you've got Ellen Ratner, who said she spoke to Assange, who said it wasn't a state actor. Assange, of course, puts out $10,000 reward for any information on Seth Rich's murderer. You've got Cy Hirsch, who says a high-level FBI source had looked at the Seth Rich file and said that Rich was involved. And then you have the FBI lying in response to the FOIA on information on Seth. You have the NSA saying they can't release stuff on Rich because it's national security. Okay. So, I mean, that's just some of it. You have the veteran intelligence professionals technical report showing it was local download, not a hack, that was done by Bill Binney and others. You have the former UK diplomat, Craig Murray, who was involved in WikiLeaks, who says he was involved in WikiLeaks getting information, confirming the veteran intelligence professionals' persanity scenario. Now, Kim.com, what is your assessment of his credibility? Because he says he has evidence that Seth Rich was the WikiLeaks source and that he's willing to talk to Congress about it.
You know, he's a quirky character, but I think he may well be onto something. I certainly would not rule it out. I've actually reached out to his attorney to try to see if I could broker something to get him to talk. He's wanting to hold back, hoping he can negotiate some kind of deal so that the U.S. will drop charges. Of course, the U.S. is trying to extradite him and bring him here and charge him with crimes. I am hoping that the new, if the Republicans take over Congress and Jim Jordan becomes chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I don't know that he would ever reach out to Kim.com. I kind of doubt that he would, but I would hope that he would really start putting the fire to the FBI, forcing them to answer some questions about Russian collusion and specifically why they've covered up all these records about Seth Rich. I mean, if there's nothing to hide, then why devote so much energy to hiding it?
You spent 5 years, took you 5 years to get this one decision, right?
Right.
So what do you think is going to be, I mean, they've got 14 days to produce something.
There, right now they've got 10.
Okay, so they've got 10. Now, what do you suppose they're going to do to try and not have to produce what you've asked for, what you've been granted?
Well, I think first they're going to ask for more time. They may or may not get that. But I think actually one of the bases for requesting more time from the trial judge is they're probably going to ask the Court of Appeals to step in and block the release of this data. I don't think they're going to succeed, but I think there's a better than even chance that they will ask the Court of Appeals to stop it.
Based on what?
They don't want to release it. I mean,
no, I know they don't want to release it, but they have to get some kind of an answer that would, you know, stick.
Yeah, I see your point. That really the only thing they've got to stand on is that privacy argument. I'm thinking, going off the top of my head here, I don't think there have been any cases in the Fifth Circuit, which is the Court of Appeals in question, that have addressed that privacy issue. So the way it works is, since the Court of Appeals here in Texas has never dealt with it, they look to the D.C. Circuit for guidance. The trial court did. Okay. But the D.C. Circuit's in our favor on this one. So really all they could do is ask the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit to go a different direction. I don't think they're going to do that.
Are there any other avenues such as CloudStrike, the DNC? I mean, don't they still have some of the data? I know what you're looking for on Seth's laptop is different, but if we're looking for information about interference, Russian interference, I mean, certainly there are other avenues, right?
There are. And that, that goes back into the idea of being able to file civil lawsuits and using subpoena power to get to some of this stuff. And I mentioned Jim Jordan earlier. I hope he or someone starts to really lean on the government to produce some of these records. That's the fastest way we're going to get this stuff, if we get it.
Is there anybody in Congress following what you're doing?
No, and it's funny that you ask. I have joked that the Seth Rich story is the last bus stop before Pizzagate. Nobody wants to touch this thing. I mean, if you even mention it, all of a sudden you're blackballed. You're no longer a member of polite society. I mean, if you're a journalist, your career is over. So, yeah, it's a bizarre
Not
thing.
Not entirely. No. I've been following this and covering it for... Well,
Let me clarify. If you are an establishment journalist, CBS, New York Times, take your pick.
You
cannot, even Fox News, if you're at Fox News, if you're at Newsmax, this story is off limits. It's only left to, you know, a handful of us heretics who are bloggers or radio or podcasters, because the quote unquote mainstream people will not touch it.
Well, I want to know what you think is going to happen from here. I mean, first of all, you've had an inside view of some really corrupt shenanigans, let's put it that way, on right. the part of the government's FOIA people. And I guess you're still dealing with that, although you do have a judge. Do you think the judge is aware that, what do you think is the judge's feeling about the way the FBI has conducted itself?
I think he sees, I mean, because we gave him overwhelming evidence outside of this case, you know, cases from the DC District Court where one judge in particular was talking about the FBI's history of institutional violations, you know, institutionalized violations of FOIA. So he knows what's going on. I think that, and of course, I don't know what's going on in his head specifically, but I think the average federal judge doesn't want to go too far out on a limb on this stuff. I think we have to take what we can get and just chip away at it gradually.
Where do you think you're going to be a year from now?
Hopefully the Court of Appeals will have already addressed some things. Maybe we will start getting some of those emails and other documents that they've held back. If we get enough off the laptop, we may start filing some civil lawsuits.
Well, if you get raided at 3 a.m. in the morning, I think you're probably onto something.
You know, sadly, I have contemplated that, you know, who knows? Maybe it's because I took the mattress, the tag off a mattress or something.
Have you run into any weirdness since you've been working on this?
You know, occasionally the weird clicks and sounds on my phone, but nothing like what, say Cheryl Atkinson has experienced, nothing on that level. So, yeah, for whatever reason, for the most part, they have left me alone.
Well, maybe if you actually get access to what you're asking for, that could be a life-changing situation for you right there.
It could. I have contemplated that. And, you know, I will say also that some of my clients have indeed experienced computer intrusions, people getting into their electronics, things like that. You know, we strongly suspect that people who have approached us have been government agents trying to, you know, give us bad information in order to allow us to discredit ourselves. So there are things like that are going on.
I just have a quick question. So let's assume you get the data, you get the laptop. What is it that you want to find? What is it that you think you're going to find on that laptop that's important?
I think my suspicion is unless that laptop has been completely, you know, bleached, was a bleach bit and every shred of data wiped out, I think we will find that some files were deleted during the time that the family had the laptop. That's my suspicion.
Well, what happens if you get a bleached laptop?
Well, then we know we're on the right track. There would be no reason to do that to a laptop unless you really had something to hide. Now, interestingly, We had also requested his work laptop, and we're asking the judge to clarify whether that's also included, the work laptop. But according to what CrowdStrike has said publicly, they had everybody in the DNC wipe their, reset their computers to factory settings. I'm trying to remember if it, I believe it was in June of 2016. So CrowdStrike, almost from the outset, wiped a ton of data. And so, of course, that begs the question, why?
Well, the cover-up continues. But listen, I think this is a great victory, no matter what happens.
Yeah. Thank you.
And I wish you all the best. And
Thank
we're keeping an eye on this thing.